This is Audible.
Audible Modern Vanguard presents The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan. Narrated by Parker Posey.
Introduction. Anna Quinlan. My mother's reading a paperback book at the kitchen table. This is odd. My mother is not a great reader, and usually she reads only before bed, hardcover books that come from the Book of the Month Club, novels by Taylor Caldwell and Daphne du Maurier and Mary Stuart. But she is hunched over this paperback, frowning, twin divots between her dark brows. I cannot remember many of the specific details of my childhood, but I remember this moment well. I am 12. This is how I first encountered Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. When I read the book myself, 8 years later, as an assignment for a women's studies class at Barnard, I immediately understand why my mother had become so engrossed that she found herself reading in the place usually reserved for cooking. I don't believe she was particularly enthralled by Friedan's systematic evisceration of the theories of Sigmund Freud or the prescient indictment of American consumerism. I think it was probably the notion of seeing her own life there in the pages of that book, the endless, thankless cycle of dishes and vacuuming and meals and her husband's ironing and her children's laundry. I begin to feel I have no personality, one woman told Friedan. I'm a server of food and a putter on of pants and a bedmaker, somebody who can be called on when you want something, but who am I? Who am I? My mother must have been asking herself at the table in the kitchen, and with her millions of others who would pore over this painstakingly reported, fiercely opinionated book. My mother had everything a woman after World War II was told she could want, told by the magazines and the movies and the television commercials. A husband with a good job, 5 healthy children, a lovely home in the suburbs, a patio, and a powder room. But in the drawer of her bureau, she kept a small portfolio of the drawings she had done in high school, the pages growing yellower year by year. My bag lunches for school sometimes included a hard-boiled egg, and on its shell she would paint in watercolors the face of a princess, a seaside scene. I cracked those eggs without thinking twice. It has been almost 40 years since The Feminine Mystique was first published in 1963, and since then so much has changed, and too little, too, so that rereading the book now feels both revolutionary and utterly contemporary. It changed my life. I am far from alone in this. Susan Brownmiller says the same in the opening pages of her memoir of the women's movement. It changed Friedan's life, too. She became a celebrity, a pariah, a standard bearer, a target. She founded the National Organization for Women, and her name became synonymous with the Equal Rights Amendment and late 20th century feminism. And it changed the lives of millions upon millions of other women who jettisoned empty hours of endless housework and found work and meaning outside of raising their children and feeding their husbands. Out of Friedan's argument that women have been coaxed into selling out their intellect and their ambitions for the paltry price of a new washing machine, a baked potato is not as big as the world, she noted puckishly of their stunted aspirations, came a great wave of change in which women demanded equality and parity under the law and in the workplace. Hillary Rodham Clinton, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Girls in Little League, Women Rabbis, it is no exaggeration to say that the feminine mystique set the stage for them all. What Friedan gave to the world was the problem that has no name. She not only named it, but dissected it. The advances of science, the development of labor-saving appliances, the development of the suburbs, all had come together to offer women in the 1950s a life their mothers had scarcely dreamed of, free from rampant disease, onerous drudgery, noxious city streets. But the green lawns and big corner lots were isolating. The housework seemed to expand to fill the time available, and polio and smallpox were replaced by depression and alcoholism. All that was covered up in a kitchen conspiracy of denial. If a woman had a problem in the 1950s and 1960s, she knew that something must be wrong with her marriage or with herself, Friedan wrote, based on both her reporting and her own experience. This was preposterous, she argued. Instead, the problem was with the mystique of waxed floors and perfectly applied lipstick. She reinforced her sense of what was wrong with studies showing diminished ambitions for students at women's colleges like Vassar and Smith, increasing psychological treatment for young mothers in the suburbs, lower ages of marriage and childbirth as the mystique became the only goal in the lives of women. Those who think of the book as solely a feminist manifesto ought to revisit its pages to get a sense of the magnitude of the research and reporting Friedan undertook. It is an ambitious book in that way, a book wary of those many who will want to attack both the messenger and the message, a book carefully marshaling and buttressing its arguments. And it is an ambitious book in its scope, too. It might have been an important one simply on the basis of its early chapters detailing the vague malaise afflicting women who were thought to be a uniquely blessed and contented generation. But it is an enduring one because of the other related issues Friedan addresses. Her explication of the role of consumerism to reinforce American social strata is stunning, even now that we take the buying and the selling of ourselves for granted. In every great manifesto, there are riveting moments of self-awareness. In The Feminine Mystique, one of them is the rhetorical question, why is it never said that the really crucial function, the really important role that women serve as housewives is to buy more things for the house? At moments like those, the reader must remind herself that this book was written well before the consumer movement, the anti-war movement, the movement toward a counterculture. It was prescient, and it continues to be so. For while the lives of women have changed radically in many ways since Friedan described a generation of educated housewives maniacally arranging the silverware and dressing to welcome their husbands home from work, the covert messages the culture sends to women today are still pernicious. So the chapters that describe the overinvestment of mothers in their children, the cult of the child, still resonate both with women who have chosen not to work outside the home and those who have, both of whom feel under cultural fire. And the description of children who never grow up might as well have been written yesterday. Behind the senseless vandalism, the riots in Florida at spring vacation, the promiscuity, the rise in teenage venereal disease and illegitimate pregnancies, the alarming dropouts from high school and college, was this new passivity. For those bored, lazy, gimme kids, kicks was the only way to kill the monotony of vacant time. 40 years ago, those words appeared. It seems scarcely possible. In those 40 years, the feminine mystique has sometimes been devalued. Friedan the author became inextricably intertwined with Friedan the public figure, the latter often identified with internecine squabbles with other feminist leaders and a combative public persona. In hindsight, the shortcomings of the book become clear. Too much attention is paid to the role of institutions and publications in the reinforcement of female passivity, too little to the role of individual men who have enjoyed the services of a servant class and still resent its loss. Friedan's own revisiting of the material in The Second Stage, 1981, was not as rigorous or well-researched as The Feminine Mystique had been. While she attempted to make valid points about why some women have chosen to embrace child-rearing and a domestic life, the revisionist message of the second book appeared to be an apologia for the ferocity of her first. Perhaps there also has come to be a certain feeling among the smug overachievers of the post-Mystique generation that time had passed and passed the book by, that we had moved away from the primer into the advanced course in seizing control of our own lives. I plead guilty on this count. I expected to revisit this book as I would a period piece, interesting, worthy of notice and of homage, yet a little dated and obvious as well. The daughter of a quiet and contained housewife, I had become an opinion columnist in the onslaught of change that this book began, and I expected to be properly grateful, which is to say, slightly condescending. As casually as I once cracked those painstakingly painted eggs as a girl, I cracked the spine of this book, and as my mother had been in a different world at a different time, under hugely different circumstances, I was enwrapped. 4 decades later, millions of individual transformations later, there is still so much to learn from this book about how sex and home and work and norms are used to twist the lives of women into weird and unnatural shapes. It set off a social and political explosion, yet it also speaks to the incomplete rebuilding of the leveled landscape. Giving a name to the problem that had no name was the necessary first step, Friedan concludes in the epilogue. But it wasn't enough. Much, much more was necessary to change our lives. But as a first step, this one is extraordinary. As a writer, I say, brava. As a beneficiary of the greatest social revolution in 20th century America, the resurgence of feminism that began with the feminine mystique, I am obliged to add, many, many thanks. Metamorphosis, two generations later. As we approach a new century and a new millennium, it's the men who have to break through to a new way of thinking about themselves and society. Too bad the women can't do it for them or go much further without them, because it's awesome to consider how women have changed the very possibilities of our lives and are changing the values of every part of our society since we broke through the feminine mystique only two generations ago. But it can't go on in terms of women alone. There's a new urgency coming from the changing situation of men, threatening to women unless men break through. Will women be forced to retreat from their empowered personhood? Or will they join with men, again, in some new vision of human possibility, changing the man's world, which they fought so hard to enter? Consider the terms of women's new empowerment, the startling changes since that time I wrote about only three decades ago, when women were defined only in sexual relation to men, man's wife, sex object, mother, housewife, and never as persons defining themselves by their own actions in society. That image, which I called the feminine mystique, was so pervasive, coming at us from the women's magazines, the movies, the television commercials, all the mass media and the textbooks of psychology and sociology, that each woman thought she was alone. It was her personal guilt if she didn't have an orgasm waxing the family room floor. No matter how much she had wanted that husband, those children, that split-level suburban house, and all the appliances thereof, which were supposed to be the limits of women's dreams in those years after World War II, she sometimes felt a longing for something more. I called it the problem that had no name, because women were blamed then for a lot of problems. Not getting the kitchen sink white enough, not pressing the husband's shirt smooth enough, the children's bedwetting, the husband's ulcers, their own lack of orgasm. But there was no name for a problem that had nothing to do with husband, children, home, sex. The problem I heard from so many women after I served my own time as a suburban housewife, fired from a newspaper job for being pregnant, guilty anyway, as women were made to feel then for working outside the home, that they were undermining their husband's masculinity and their own femininity, and neglecting their children. I was not quite able to suppress the writing itch. So, like secret drinking in the morning because no other mommy in my suburban world worked, I freelanced for women's magazines, writing articles about women and their children, breastfeeding, natural childbirth, their homes and fashions. If I tried to write about a woman artist, a political concern, American women won't identify, the editors would say. Those editors of women's magazines were men. All the terms in every field and profession then were defined by men who were virtually the only full professors, the law partners, the CEOs and company executives, the medical experts, the academicians, the hospital heads and clinic directors. There was no woman's vote. Women voted as their husbands did. No pollster or political candidate talked about women's issues. Women were not taken that seriously. Women didn't take themselves that seriously. Abortion was not a word printed in newspapers. It was a sleazy crime that shamed and terrified and often killed women, and whose practitioners could go to jail. It was only after we broke through the feminine mystique and said women are people, no more, no less, and therefore demanded our human right to participate in the mainstream of society, to equal opportunity to earn and be trained and have our own voice in the big decisions of our destiny, that the problems of women themselves became visible and women began to take their own experience seriously. Consider, in the summer of 1996, that the women athletes taking the Olympic medals from tennis, track and field, to soccer, basketball, kayak, mountain bike, and every possible competition were virtually the main show, the target of primetime television. In my growing up, or my daughter's, there were no women playing in major sports, no serious athletic training for girls in schools, only boys, until the women's movement demanded and won an end to sex discrimination in education, including athletic training. In Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, as Title VII banned discrimination in employment, equal opportunity to work and play to the limit of one's ability for women and men. Consider in 1996 that the issue of abortion as women's choice was the crucial issue splitting the Republican Party. Long since the women's movement declared the basic right of a woman to choose whether or when to have a child, long since the Supreme Court declared that right as inalienable as any right specified in the Constitution and Bill of Rights, as they were originally written of by and for the people that were men, long since the Democratic Party committed itself to the right to choose, and long since the fundamentalist religious right has been fighting a vicious rearguard action, harassing and bombing abortion clinics. The Republican Party won elections in the past inflaming fears and hate over the issue of abortion. In 1996, their platform's demand for a constitutional amendment criminalizing abortion again, putting the fetus over the life of the woman, alienated many Republican women and men, a last desperate attempt to turn the clock back. As it became clear that women, now registered to vote in increasing majority over men, would elect the next president of the United States, not just choice, but issues like family leave, the right to women not to be forced out of hospitals less than 48 hours after giving birth, the right of parents to take time off to take children to the dentist, or for a parent-teacher appointment became serious political business. While some media, ads, and movies may still try to define women only or mainly as sex objects, it's no longer considered chic or even acceptable by much of America. Far from being unspeakable and invisible, sexual abuse of women and less overt forms of sexual harassment are now considered serious enough crimes to bring down a senator or Supreme Court justice or even a president. In fact, the media's political muckrakers, and even feminist obsession with such charges, which originated as an expression of women's new empowerment, now begins to seem almost diversionary. In the focus on sexual harassment, sexual politics has become obsessed with what may in fact be a dangerous symptom of increasing male rage and frustration over economic anxieties, job downsizing, stagnant wages, and career impasse or decline. Sexual politics, we remind ourselves, started out as a reaction against the feminine mystique. It was an explosion of women's pent-up anger and rage against the put-downs they had to accept when they were completely dependent on men, the rage they took out on their own bodies and covertly on husbands and kids. That rage fueled the first battles of the women's movement and subsided with each advance woman made toward her own empowerment, her full personhood, freedom. But sexual politics now feeds the politics of hate and the growing polarization of America. It also masks the real threats now to women's empowerment and men's. The culture of corporate greed, the downsizing of jobs hitting even college-educated white males, with nearly a 20% loss of income in the last 5 years, to say nothing of minority, blue-collar, and those with less education. Footnote 1. A backlash from the men, egged on by media and political hate mongers, can make scapegoats of women again. But women are no longer the passive victims they once felt themselves to be. They cannot be pushed back easily into the feminine mystique, though some very shrewd women like Martha Stewart are making mega millions on elaborate do-it-yourself decor and cuisine, selling pretend feminine mystique pursuits as chic new choices. The fact is, women are now carrying some 50% of the income-earning burden in some 50% of households. Footnote 2. Women are now nearly 50% of the labor force. Footnote 3. 59% of women work at jobs outside the home, including the mothers of young children. Footnote 4. And women's wages are now about 72% of men's. Footnote 5. They are not equal at the top. Most of the CEOs, law partners, hospital heads, full professors, cabinet members, judges, and police chiefs are still men. But women are now represented in all levels below the very top. And more Americans now work for companies owned or run by women than by the Fortune 500. But it's troubling to learn that the closing of the earnings gender gap has come only one-third, 34%, from increases in women's earnings. Most of it, 66%, is accounted for by a drop in men's earnings. Footnote 6. And while more and more women have entered the labor force in these years, more and more men have dropped out or been forced out. It is men, first minority men, now white men, first blue collar, now middle management, who have been the main victims of corporate downsizing. Because it's the blue collar and middle management jobs held mainly by men that have been eliminated, not just by technology, but in the short-term interests of increasing the stock market price by getting rid of men's higher wages and benefits. Women's service jobs, in areas such as the health professions, are the part of the economy that is growing, but those jobs are increasingly being contracted out, put on a temporary or contingent basis without benefits. Many women's jobs, especially those contingency jobs, are not brilliant careers, but poll after poll shows women today feeling pretty good about their complex lives of job, profession, and their various choices of marriage and motherhood. Women feel that zest still, with so many more choices than their mothers had since they broke out of the feminine mystique. But the sexual politics that helped us break through the feminine mystique is not relevant or adequate, is even diversionary, in confronting the serious and growing economic imbalance, the mounting income inequality of wealth now threatening both women and men. Men, whose very masculine identity has been defined in terms of their score in the rat race, knocking the other guy down, can no longer count on that lifetime climb in job or profession. If they themselves are not yet downsized out, brothers, cousins, friends, co-workers have been, and they are more dependent now on wives' earnings. The real and growing discrepancy affecting both women and men is the sharply increased income inequality between the very rich, the top 10% who now control two-thirds of America's wealth, and the rest of us, women and men. In the last decade, 80% of Americans have seen their incomes stagnate or decline. Footnote 7. The only reason more families are not pushed into poverty is that both women and men are working. But in the present culture of greed, where all of us are told we can get rich in the stock market, it's easier to deflect the anxiety and insecurity that is growing among Americans, women and men, according to the polls, despite the booming stock market and corporate profits and the Dow Jones Index going through the roof, into sexual politics and racial and intergenerational warfare. Easier to deflect the rage by turning women and men, black and white, young and old, against each other than to openly confront the excessive power of corporate greed. I would like to see women and men mounting a new nationwide campaign for a shorter work week, as over half a century ago, labor fought for the 40-hour week, now perhaps a 30-hour week, meeting the needs of women and men in the child-rearing years who shouldn't be working 80-hour weeks as some do now. A 6-hour day, parents at work while kids are at school, also fitting the needs of men and women who from youth on will have to combine work with education and further training, and people over 60 who we know now need new ways to continue contributing their experience to society rather than draining it as candidates for nursing homes. More jobs for everybody and new definitions of success for women and men. The old wars still divide us. In the Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois, 10 miles from Peoria, where I grew up, a group of women have filed the largest lawsuit in sexual harassment history against men alleged to have subjected them to mauling of buttocks and breasts and obscene name-calling, slut, and whore, as well as refusing to give them the training and support they needed in their non-traditional jobs. In that part of Illinois, with the Caterpillar strike lost, those Mitsubishi jobs were the only good jobs left. The men were clearly threatened as women began to take those jobs. I was proud of NOW, the National Organization for Women, which I helped start when I saw we needed a movement to get beyond the feminine mystique and participate as equals in the mainstream of society. When I went to Japan to be joined by 45 Japanese women's organizations to take on Mitsubishi in its own base. But women's victory over male abuse can't last, isn't solid, until the causes of that insecurity and rage are addressed by and for women and men. Still, the new power of women is being felt all over the world now, as was made clear in 1995 at the Beijing conference. When the authoritarian Chinese government could not get the Olympics, it welcomed the UN World's Women's Conference, expecting the women to shop and pose in pretty pictures against picturesque Chinese backdrops. When 40,000 women from women's organizations and movement all over the world demanded visas and protested at Chinese embassies when they were denied, the Chinese government tried to wall off the non-government conference into an isolated suburb. But they cannot stop the women of the world. Told they could demonstrate only at a children's playground, women from Tibet who had been denied visas brought CNN to that playground and, shrouded in black, took their story to the whole world. Hillary Rodham Clinton asserted, "Women's rights are human rights, to the whole world." The official delegates to that UN conference were, of course, Women Now, empowered women, where 20 years ago they were men or wives and secretaries of male officials who took their government seats at the crucial votes. The women this time not only declared a woman's right to control her own sexuality and her childbearing as a universal human right, but declared the genital mutilation of little girls a crime against humanity. Under the feminine mystique, men all over the world took for granted their right to beat or abuse their wives. Now, in the United States and, after Beijing, in the world, they no longer can assume that right. In the United States, the Department of Justice has set up an office to train police to deal with violence against women. Violence against women seems to be increasing in the United States, partly because women are reporting as abuse what they used to accept passively as private shame, but maybe also because men's increasing frustration and desperation is being taken out on women. Studies and reports from California, Connecticut, and elsewhere show an increase in sexual abuse and violence against women, as well as suicide, child abuse, and divorce, in the face of corporate downsizing and the lack of community, the dwindling of time and concern for larger purposes in the me decade. But women's concerns now go beyond their own security. It was concern for their families, and not only their own families, but those poor or otherwise less fortunate, that motivated American women in 1996 to rise up against the Republicans' threats to cut Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, Social Security, student loans, child immunizations, and the protection of the environment. Co-opting feminist rhetoric did not get women's votes for politicians who threatened the welfare of children, old people, the sick, and the poor. Abstractions of balance the budget did not mask for women the danger of gutting government programs that protect children and older people, the sick and the poor, to provide tax cuts for the rich. A decade after the women's movement, a study by the Eagleton Institute at Rutgers University showed that the addition of even two women to a state legislature changes the political agenda, not just in the direction of women's rights, but to basic concerns of life, the lives of children, older people, the poor, and the sick. And so, paradox or full circle, or transcendent thesis, in these 30-odd years, women breaking through the feminine mystique to their own political and economic participation and empowerment in the mainstream of society are not becoming more like men, but are expressing in the public sphere some of the values that used to be expressed or allowed only in the private nurture of the home. The mystique we had to rebel against when it was used to confine us to the home, to keep us from developing and using our full personhood in society, distorted those real values women are now embracing, with new power and zest, both in the privacy of the home and in the larger society. And in so doing, they are changing the political and personal dimensions of marriage and families, home, and the society they share with men. Marriage, which used to be a woman's only way to social function and economic support, is now a choice for most women as well as for men. It no longer defines a woman completely, as it never did a man. She often keeps her own name now, or husband and wife take each other's hyphenated. In breaking through the feminine mystique, some early feminist radical rhetoric seemed to declare war on marriage, motherhood, family. The divorce rate of those 1950s feminine mystique marriages exploded from the 1960s to the 1980s. Before, no matter who went to court, it was only the man who had the economic and social independence to get a divorce. Since then, women in great numbers can and do get out of bad marriages. In some instances, women rebelled against that feminine mystique narrow role by getting out of the marriage altogether. But in others, the marriage moved to a new kind of equality and stability as women went back to school, went to law school, got promoted in serious jobs, and began to share the earning burden, which before had been the man's sole inescapable responsibility. And men began to share the child care and the housework, which before had been her exclusive, defining domain, her responsibility, and her power. It has been fascinating to see all this changing, the new problems and joys working it out. Feminist rhetoric conceptualized the politics of housework, which most women began practicing in their daily lives. Men are not yet taking absolutely equal responsibility for children and home, just as women are not yet treated as equal in many offices. I was delighted at a front page article in the New York Times some years ago proclaiming, quote, "American men not doing 50% of the housework." How wonderful, I thought, that the Times would even consider it possible, desirable front page stuff, that American men should do 50% of the housework. The sons of the feminine mystique, whose mothers made their sandwiches and picked their dirty underwear off the floor. It was progress, it seemed to me, that men who once helped, barbecuing the hamburgers while she cleaned the toilet bowl, were even doing 20%. Now, according to the latest figures, American men are doing 40% of the housework and child care. Footnote 8. I doubt they're doing much ironing, but neither are the women. I've seen reports that sales of those soaps women were supposed to throw in those appliances to keep them running 24 hours a day went way down during those years. And families started buying 25-watt light bulbs to hide the dust until Saturday when they all cleaned house together. But it didn't make me happy to read recently that only 35% of American families have one meal a day together. The fact is, the divorce rate is no longer exploding. And most of the divorces now are among the very young, not those who have gone through these changes. In the second decade after the women's movement, I came across statistics from a population institute in Princeton that more American couples were having sex more often and enjoying it than ever before. Footnote 9. In my early research for the feminine mystique, I'd seen data from history that with every decade of women's advance toward equality with men, measures of satisfying sexual intercourse between women and men increased. There's a lot of data now that equality is strongly related to a good, lasting marriage, though there may also be more arguing between equals. At the American Sociological Association meetings in August 1995, I was asked to speak on the future of marriage. I saw that future in terms of new strengths of women and men and new challenges for society. For instance, in all the arguments about men not doing enough of the housework and child care, I've heard women recently admit that they don't like it when men take over so much of it that the kid comes to daddy first with her report card or cut finger. "I wouldn't consider letting Ben take him to the doctor," my friend Sally said. "That's my thing." There was a lot of power in women's role in the family that wasn't visible even to the feminists, according to the male measures. More studies need to be done to test what strengths are added to families when mothers and fathers share the nurturing power. All we hear about, all we talk about, are the problems. The stresses, for women, of combining work and family, the deficit for children growing up in a single-parent family. We don't hear about the studies at the Wellesley Center for Research on Women, which show that combining work and family reduces stress for women, is better for women's mental health than the old either-or single role, and that women's mental health no longer declines sharply after menopause as it used to do. We don't hear about the different kinds of strengths and support single-parent families need and could get from their communities. But there is a new awareness that something has to change now in the structure of society because the hours and conditions of jobs and professional training are still based on the lives of the men of the past who had wives to take care of the details of life. Women don't have such wives, but neither do most men now. So the family-friendly workplace becomes a conscious political and collective bargaining issue, flex time, job sharing, parental leave. It turns out that companies on the cutting edge in terms of technology and the bottom line are also the ones adopting family-friendly policies. The United States has been backward compared to the other advanced industrial nations in this regard. 98% of 3 to 4-year-olds in France and Belgium are in a preschool program. Footnote 10. The United States was the last industrial nation, except South Africa, to adopt a national parental leave policy, only after Bill Clinton took office. There's also a growing sense that it takes more than one mother, one father, much less a single mother, to raise a child. It takes a village to raise a child, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton said in a best-selling book in 1996. There's a new awareness of the values of diversity and of the need of all families for a larger, stronger community. It's a far cry from that single model of the isolated suburban feminine mystique family of the 60s. Not only the many variations, some couples having babies in their 40s, women and men, well established in careers, some juggling work, profession, training, and home with babies in their 20s and 30s. Sometimes the woman taking a year or two off, or the man if they can afford it, and single parents, all of them relying more than ever on support from grandparents, play groups with other parents, company, church, or community child care. And more women and men living alone or together, young and older, in new patterns. The recent campaign to legalize same-sex marriage shows the powerful appeal of lasting emotional commitment, even for men or women who depart from conventional sexual norms. In 1994 to 1995, at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., I led a seminar for policymakers looking beyond sexual politics, beyond identity politics, beyond gender, toward a new paradigm of women, men, and community. In 1996, we focused on reframing family values in the context of new economic realities. I have never bought the seeming polarization between feminism and families. A demagogic reprise of the old feminine mystique, the recent reactionary Family Values campaign, is basically an attack on abortion, divorce, and above all, the rights and autonomy of women. But there are real values having to do with families, with mothering and fathering and bonds between the generations, with all our needs to get and to give love and nurture that are women's public and private concerns today and the crux of the political gender gap in 1996. The question is, when will men turn on the culture of greed and say, is this all? The old separatism, women versus men, is no longer relevant, is in fact being transcended. Just as the Playboy clubs were shut down some years after the women's movement, it no longer seemed sexy, evidently, for women to pretend they were bunnies. In 1997, Esquire magazine is in trouble, and the publisher of Miss and Working Mother put them up for sale. All that was revolutionary 20 years ago, he said, but now it's part of society. The trend-setting New Yorker is now edited by a woman and devoted its signature anniversary issue in 1996 to women. In the 1996 campaign, both Hillary Rodham Clinton and Elizabeth Dole displayed but also tried to hide the power that comes from successful careers of their own. Both focused their power on traditional women's issues, the Red Cross, children, but with all the new political sophistication and organizational machinery that women now command for those issues. No longer was it possible to hide the new image of marriage between equals coming from the White House, despite the backing and filing when a new strong First Lady's voice is heard openly in the highest political councils. A clear sense exists on both sides of the political aisle of a partnership between women and men way beyond the feminine mystique. At the same time, the historic new gender gap between women and men in the presidential election race portends an inexorable shifting of the national political agenda toward concerns that used to be dismissed as women's issues. So, as a result of women's growing political power, the old feminine mystique is now being transformed into unprecedented new political reality and priority for both parties. It was the Wall Street Journal that first reported this with front page headlines, January 11, 1996. In historic numbers, men and women split over presidential race. The journal reported, if current trends continue, the split between men and women would be wider in the 1996 presidential election than in any in recent history. This could, in fact, be the first modern election in which men and women collectively come down on different sides of a presidential race. The 1996 race is currently characterized by a gender gap of historic proportions, says Peter Hart, a Democratic pollster who helps conduct the Wall Street Journal / NBC News polls. Indeed, in a Journal / NBC poll early last month, the president and Senator Dole were in a virtual dead heat among the American men. But among women, the president led Senator Dole by 54% to 36%. The Journal also noted that the president's strength among women voters, which has increased amid fierce debate over the budget, is the principal reason he has bounced back in most recent polls. In essence, says Mr. Hart, the president's current strength comes entirely from women, who are leaning so strongly toward the Democrats today that even homemakers, a traditional GOP base group, are supporting President Clinton. As to name the main issues facing the nation, men are nearly twice as likely as women to cite the budget deficit or cutting government spending, which are the top GOP priorities. Women, in turn, are far more likely to cite social problems, such as education and poverty. Attempts to scale back Medicare and the wrangling over social spending has affected women of all ages who tend to assume greater responsibilities for caring for the young and the old. That often leaves them worrying more than men when social programs aimed at those populations are being scaled back. Significantly, it is such broad social concerns and not the character or sexual issues that now define the gender gap, even though the new frustrations of men became the target of the politics of hate, as played by Pat Buchanan in the Republican primaries. The political gurus on both sides were nonplussed. The old assumptions about the final power of the white male still held, but uneasily, for more and more white men were joining even more men of color in these new concerns. And it became apparent to old and new political establishments. They can no longer win without the women, not just token passive supporters, but active policymakers. For women elected the President of the United States in 1996 by a 17% gender gap, and a woman, for the first time, is now Secretary of State. It is awesome to see these waves begin to transform the political landscape. A lot of Republicans joining Democrats finally in voting to increase the minimum wage. The Republicans retreating from their brutal attacks on Medicaid, Medicare, Head Start, food stamps, children's inoculations, student loans, environmental protection, even affirmative action. The concrete concerns of life, women's concerns, now front and center, taking priority over the abstractions of budget balancing. A new movement confronting the concrete new realities of the growing income discrepancy in America affecting women, men, and their children, fueling the politics of hate. I was happy in 1996 to join other new, younger women leaders in alliance with the militant new leadership of the AFL-CIO in planning speakouts against this growing income chasm in favor of a living wage for everyone, no longer women versus men. What has to be faced now by women and men together are the life-threatening excesses of the culture of greed, of brutal, unbridled corporate power. There has to be a new way of defining and measuring the bottom line of corporate and personal competition and success and national budget priorities. The welfare of the people, the common good, has to take priority over the narrow measure of the next quarter's stock market price increase, escalating executive compensation, and even over our separate single issue. And some visionary CEOs, as well as male politicians, begin to see this. But the women are beginning to get impatient. The Hollywood Women's Political Committee, which had raised millions of dollars to elect liberal senators and President Clinton, voted to disband in protest against money as a dominant force in American politics and against the betrayal of the politicians who supported so-called welfare reform, which abolished aid to families with dependent children. New birth control technology, even beyond RU486, as well as the evolving national consensus, will soon make the whole issue of abortion obsolete. As important as it was, it should never have been a single-issue litmus test for the women's movement. The male spin doctors and political advisors to presidents and both political parties still do not get the totality of women's new empowerment, or they would not have advised the passage and signing of a welfare bill that pushed 1 million children into poverty. For the women's movement, for this nation, other issues of choice must now involve us. Choice having to do with diverse patterns of family life and career and the economic wherewithal for women and men of all ages and races to have choice in their lives, not just the very rich. Choices of how we live and choices of how we die. The paradox continues to deepen, opening new serious consideration of real values and women's experience that were hidden beneath the feminine mystique. There is much talk lately of a third sector, of civic virtue, Harvard professors and others discovering that the real bonds that keep a society flourishing are not necessarily wealth, oil, trade, technology, but bonds of civic engagement, the voluntary associations that observers from de Tocqueville on saw as the lifeblood of American democracy. The decline of these organizations is blamed in part on women working. All those years when women did the PTAs and Scouts and Church and Sodalities and Ladies Village Improvement Society for free, no one valued them much at all. Now that women take themselves seriously and get paid and taken seriously, such community work in its absence in 1996 America is now being taken seriously too. Some social scientists and political gurus, right and left, propose that the third sector can take over much of the welfare responsibilities of government. But the women who constituted the third sector know that it cannot all alone assume the larger responsibilities of government. Our democracy requires a new sense of combined public, private, civic, and corporate responsibility. In 1996, I flew back to Peoria to help give a funeral eulogy to my best friend from high school and college, Harriet Vance Parkhurst, mother of five, Republican committee woman, and ingrained Democrat. Harriet went home to Peoria after World War II, married a high school classmate who became a Republican state senator, and while raising five kids, chaired and championed every community campaign and new cause from a museum and symphony to Head Start and women's rights. There were front page news stories and long editorials in the Peoria papers on Harriet's death. She wasn't rich and famous. She had no male signs of power. I like to think this new serious tribute to a woman who led the community in nourishing those bonds once silently taken for granted as women's lot was not only a personal tribute to my dear friend, but a new sign of the seriousness with which women's contributions, once masked, trivialized by the feminine mystique, are now taken. In other ways, too, it's the widening of the circle since we broke through the feminine mystique, not the either-or win-lose battles that stirs me now. A reporter asks me, in one of those perennial evaluations of wither women, what is the main battle now for women? Who's winning? Who's losing? And I think that question almost sounds obsolete. That's not the way to put it. Women put up a great battle in Congress and the states to get breast cancer taken seriously, get mammograms covered by health insurance. But the bigger new threat to women's lives is lung cancer, with cigarette advertising using feminist themes to get women hooked on smoking while men are quitting. The large sections in bookstores and libraries, now given over to books analyzing every aspect of women's identity in every historical period and far-flung nation or tribe, the endless variations on men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and how to communicate with each other, they just don't get it, are surfeiting. Men's colleges have become almost extinct in America. When the courts decree that the Virginia Military Institute and the Citadel can no longer be funded by the state unless they give women equal and not separate military training, the new attempt to claim that separate sex colleges or high schools are better for women, that the poor little dears will never learn to raise their voices if they have to study and compete with men, is, for me, reactive and regressive, a temporary obsolete timidity. In colleges and universities, from the smallest community college to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, women's studies are not only taught as a serious separate discipline, but in every discipline now, new dimensions of thought and history are emerging as women scholars and men analyze women's experience, once a dark continent. In June 1996, the first national conference devoted to female American writers of the 1800s, held at Trinity College in Hartford, received proposals for 250 papers. The level of interest and sophistication of those papers was absolutely unimaginable 10 years ago, said the organizers of the conference. The 19th century female writers were dealing with the large social and political problems of the time, such as slavery, industrial capitalism, and, after the Civil War, the color line, said Joan D. Hedrick, a Trinity College history professor whose biography of Harriet Beecher Stowe won a Pulitzer Prize last year. Women did not have a vote during this period. The only way they could represent themselves was through their writing. But these writers were ignored as male deconstructionists and their feminist followers wiped out in the postmodern canon what Professor Paul Lauder termed the idea of sentiment, the idea of tears, the idea of being moved by literature, the idea of being political. And now women are bringing back those larger issues and concerns with life beyond the dead abstractions into politics and not just letters. And so today, women are no longer a dark continent in literature or any academic discipline, though some feminist scholars continue to debate victim history. In a review of The Image of Man, The Creation of Modern Masculinity by the eminent historian George L. Moss, The New Republic, June 10, 1996, Roy Porter says, "What remains hidden from history today is the male, not that the accomplishments of men have been neglected. Historical research has always centered on men's lives. Tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, rich man, poor man, beggar man. The very term men could automatically serve a double function, referring equally to males or humans. When those who strutted on the historical stage were almost invariably male, being a man performing in the theater of works, politics, power was simply assumed to be natural. And when allegedly male traits, such as fighting, were occasionally questioned by pacifists or protesters, the dead white European males dominating the academy and the airwaves were deft at belittling such criticisms as hysterical or utopian on the grounds that a man's gotta do what a man's gotta do. It was the women's movement, not surprisingly, which first put maleness under cross-examination." But the book so far, the take on the masculine mystique and the so-called men's studies and men's movement have too often been literal copies in reverse of women's lib and thus, by definition, inauthentic. Or a revisionist desperate embrace of the outmoded, stunted, brutal, youth-arrested machismo that still in America seems to define masculinity. Robert Bly, in his poetry, may exhort men to tears, but in those forest camps he led them to tribal chest-thumping, breast-beating exercises in caveman male impersonation, banging those drums in their fake lion loincloths. The gun-obsessed militiamen have threatened the very foundation of society with that obsolete masculinity. We feminists have become so obsessed with the liberating force of our own authenticity, breaking through that obsolete feminine mystique, embracing the new possibilities of our own personhood, that we have lately regarded men mainly as they oppressed us, bosses, husbands, lovers, police, or failed to carry their share of the housework, childcare, the relationship, the feelings we now demanded of them, even as we learned the professional skills and political power games and started to carry the earning responsibilities once expected only of men. Those straight-line corporate and professional careers still structured in terms of the lives of the men of the past whose wives took care of the details of life, we now know pose real, sometimes insuperable, problems for women today. What we haven't noticed is the crisis, the mounting desperation of the men still defined in terms of those no longer reliable, downsized, outshifted, disappearing lifetime corporate and professional careers. Because we know men have all that power, dead white men did, we just don't take seriously and they don't admit the seriousness of those 8 years American women now live longer than men. 72, men's life expectancy today, 80, women's. The research I explored for my 1993 book, The Fountain of Age, showed two things crucial for living vital, long lives. Purposes and projects that use one's abilities, structure one's days, and keep one moving as a part of our changing society, and bonds of intimacy. But for men whose project was laid out in that no longer to be relied on lifetime career, there's chaos now. They need the flexibility women were forced to develop, raising kids, fitting profession, job, and family together somehow, inventing a changing pattern for life as it came along. For that long lifetime, men desperately need now the ease in creating and sustaining bonds of intimacy and sharing feelings that used to be relegated as women's business. For, let's face it finally, what used to be accepted, man as measure of all things, must now be reconsidered. Women and men are now both occupying the mainstream of society and defining the terms. The standards, the definitions, the very measures we live by have to change, are changing, as women's and men's shared new reality sweeps aside the obsolete remnants of the feminine mystique and its machismo counterpart. And so, in a politics where women's newly conscious voting power now exceeds men's, life concerns, care of the young and old, sickness and health, the choice when and whether to have a baby, family values, now define the agenda more than the old abstractions of deficit and the missiles of death. In August 1996, the New York Times reports a fashion crisis. Women are no longer buying high-style clothes. Men are. Ads and commercials sell Dad's Night to Cook, perfume, and facelifts for men. That baby in the backpack makes young men now strong enough to be tender. They may grow up, those men, out of the child man that has defined masculinity until now. And those women athletes taking the spotlight at the 96 Olympics, what standards will they change? The ads and the fashion magazines may still feature American prepubescent child women or push silicone-stuffed breasts that can't even respond to human touch, but young girls growing up now are also sold the training shoes and the new ideals of strength. Will new women no longer need men to be taller, stronger, earn more? Grown-up men and women, no longer obsessed with youth, outgrowing finally children's games and obsolete rituals of power and sex, become more and more authentically themselves. And they do not pretend that men are from Mars or women are from Venus. They even share each other's interests, talk a common shorthand of work, love, play, kids, politics. We may now begin to glimpse the new human possibilities when women and men are finally free to be themselves, know each other for who they really are, and define the terms and measures of success, failure, joy, triumph, power, and the common good together.